everybody. My name's Yon. If you don't know me, I'm one of the pastors, and I get the privilege of preaching today because Team Williams is in Springfield doing wedding number two. Not really a wedding, but they're celebrating with all of Dan's son-in-law's extended family in Springfield with their recent nuptials. And the best part of me preaching is that you don't have to listen to me talk about announcements, right? You get someone like Michelle, who's up here doing meditative breathing and all sorts of things, and she's not rambling on for hours, right? So that's probably the best part. The worst part is you have to listen to me ramble on for even longer. So, but we are right in the middle of our series, Myth-Busting, How to Win the Worldview War. And how many of you know that a lot of times we have just like always generations are kind of poking fun at each other and saying, well, back in my day, it was this or it was harder. You know, the new generation is like, well, you don't know what it's like today. But you know that this current generation and every generation afterwards will be the most marketed to generation in the history of the world. Facebook makes somewhere between $100 and $125 billion a year in ad revenue, right? Just pumping advertisements into our eyeballs every second of every day. And in order to kind of rise above the noise of all of this advertising and all this marketing, what do you need? You need a really catchy slogan, right? So we're going to do a little test before we start off. We're going to see how well some of these big companies are doing with their slogans, okay? So let me see this. This is an easy one. What's Nike's slogan? Just do it, right? Everyone knows that they've nailed it. They've got their, that is everything Nike does. Just do it, right? Very good. Let's see. What about Geico? You know Geico's? 15 minutes, you could say 15% or more, right? So look at that. Who says that all the time? The little gecko, right? Of course, beautiful, right? Boom, we're nailing it. Okay, this might be a little bit harder. One of the most popular car companies in the country, in the world, Toyota. What's Toyota's, you know? Let's go places. Wow. All right. This is my family. It's my extended family over here. They're crushing it right now. So I didn't give them the answers. Trust me. What about this one? How many of you like fast food? Right? What about, this is kind of like not even maybe in the top five fast food joints, but KFC. What's KFC's? Finger licking good. Okay. Look, look, all of these very catchy little slogans stick in our brains. And what do I know about it? I know that evidently KFC is finger-licking good, right? Evidently I know I can do something if I put a pair of Nikes on or put a little swoosh, right, on my shirt. One that has been around for 25 years, maybe 30 years, and this isn't even a beverage that I drink, but it is this one right here. Obey your thirst, right? This is it's been around for 25 or 30 years. And this is a genius marketing plan by Sprite, because what are they tapping into? They're tapping into the idea that everybody is thirsty, right? You can't go, you're going to die if you don't have water for 3 days. So we're going to get thirsty. And you need to obey that thirst and obey it to Sprite, right? Now, one of the things I found as I was kind of researching this, I was shocked because this kind of made me feel a little bit old, but they actually upgraded. They upgraded Obey Your Thirst. It's been 25 years. They moved on. And this kind of gives us a good picture of generationally where we are and where we're going. And they have a new one, and it says Thirst for Yours, right? And they actually don't let the slogan stand for itself. They actually give us a little Sprite manifesto, right? There's also that, too. I was going to show you a picture of like in the early late 90s, you know how they redid slogans like prayer for Bayer and like spirit for Sprite? Like, you know, those were a thing back in the 90s, but I wasn't going to do that. But Sprite has actually laid out their manifesto, and here's what they say. Thirst for yours, so go get yours. Like, pursue whatever it is you're thirsty for. It says, be hip-hop's first trillionaire. That'd be nice, right? Maybe not the hip-hop part, but the trillionaire for me. Going triple-double platinum, getting 10 billion views, having more rings than fingers. That is talking about championships. If you're not a sports person, right, you get a championship ring every time you win, so you want more than you have fingers. It's kind of a big deal. And then finally, a refreshing ice-cold Sprite. And then they say, whatever it is you want, thirst for yours. Now, can we just pause and reread this? And acknowledge how absurdly ridiculous this thing is, this marketing campaign. Who wants to be a trillionaire? That would be pretty great, right? I'd love to be a trillionaire. Who wants to be so successful in the music industry? You have all these platinum records. Me. Who wants to be a billion views? I do. Who wants to have more rings and fingers? I do. And then suddenly they just slip in a refreshing ice cold Sprite. Like that is somehow equivalent. Like I enjoy a carbonated bottle of high fructose corn syrup that won't stain my teeth as much as anybody, but it's in that list. So it's patently ridiculous, but it's also equally genius, because what is Sprite doing? Sprite is tapping into the fact that every good marketer, if you watch Mad Men, you can watch someone who creates advertisements while also searching for the very thing he's trying to sell. But they're not selling a product, they're selling you a life. They're selling you something that quenches a thirst that goes deeper than just the physical. And so today we are going to look at the common cultural myth that says I can find true satisfaction in this world apart from God. Something that marketers are telling us every single day, and something that people are trying to pursue and find true satisfaction in this world apart from God. So we're going to debunk this myth. Now, Sprite, as genius as they are to use the thirst metaphor, they are not the only ones to do it. In fact, this has been a common metaphor in Scripture for quite a long time. And we can kind of get a good picture of what this myth looks like in our culture and in kind of how humans pursue their thirst beyond that physical. And we look in Jeremiah chapter 2, verses 11 through 13. And he says this, "Has any nation ever traded its gods for new ones? Even though they are not gods at all." God is speaking. This is essentially the condemnation to the people of Israel from God to the nation of Israel, saying, this is why you're going to be facing judgment. Some context. "So has any nation ever traded its gods for new ones, even though they are not gods at all? Yet my people have exchanged their glorious God for worthless idols. The heavens are shocked at such a thing and shrink back in horror and dismay, says the Lord. For my people have done two evil things. They have abandoned me, the fountain of living water, and they have dug for themselves cracked cisterns that can hold no water at all." If you don't know what a cistern is just a waterproof thing that you build that collects rainwater so that you can drink it later. So what is God saying? Is that the condemnation is that his people, humanity, has traded their relationship knowing God, the source of living water, for broken, cracked cisterns that don't even hold water. And you can't even drink from it. If there is water in there, it's polluted because they're cracked and broken. So it provides us this picture of how does this show up? I can find true satisfaction in this world apart from God. And what am I doing? All of humanity is trading our relationship with God, the source of living water, for broken and cracked cisterns. And we are pursuing the quenching of our thirst in other places. And the proliferation of this myth is actually reaching a cultural crisis if you were to look around. Some people might disagree with the idea that this is a crisis, that people are pursuing the quenching of their thirst somewhere other than God, trying to find it in this world. You might say, well, why is that a problem? There's more people today who have the freedom to pursue and quench whatever thirst they have in whatever way they want. Some people would say, that sounds pretty good. What's wrong with that? But if we look at some of the symptoms of this, the proliferation of this myth, we can see a lot of things. We see exponential increase in a mental health crisis. A lot of it is spurred on by the social media platforms. The world, the ecosystem that involves social media. We see a mental health crisis. We see many more people who are full of rage and anger and outbursts. Anyone know someone like that? Probably on social media, right? But they're angry. We see increased, heightened levels of anxiety around the little things of life and the big things of life, and everything in between. Anxiety around uncertainty. And so the proliferation of this myth is creating a cultural crisis, because everybody is searching for something that will truly satisfy, that will truly quench our thirst. And this isn't unique to our culture. There are just some unique symptoms that come along with it. This has been going on for years and years and years. Thousands of years, really what it means to be a human is the pursuit of this true quenching and true satisfaction. We can see this through some people who have actually attained the ultimate. The thing that we're pursuing, the thing that Sprite would say, here's the ultimate peak. The good thing is most of us actually don't have the opportunity to get to the top, right? So we don't actually get to experience what it's like to realize, oh, this really isn't all it's cracked up to be. But there are some people through history who have achieved that mountaintop, and they give us a window into how dissatisfying it actually is, the pursuit of this. In the Bible, there's one, Solomon, King Solomon, back in the Old Testament. The richest man, the most powerful, had a couple thousand concubines, so whether it was sex, money, the most wise person, whether it was intellect, he had it all. And what was his conclusion? It's all meaningless. Ancient Greeks, there was a philosopher, a poet named Horace, and he was best friends with someone, and this best friend happened to become Caesar Augustus. Wouldn't that be luck? We want to be best friends with the future ruler of the entire world? And so he reaches the pinnacle, and he says, I've been to the mountaintop, and there's nothing there. We fast forward in the modern day, Rockefeller, arguably the richest man in the history of the world, when asked by a reporter, how much more do you need? How much more money do you need? What was his answer? $1, or some people say, just a little more. Just one more. Never ending. I almost had Pastor Jonathan play the song, famous song. When you think of the word satisfaction, what song comes to your mind? Can't get no satisfaction, right? So we'll play that after the service or after the preaching. Don't worry. Stick around. Yep. Bono, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. See, it doesn't matter. There are certain people who reach the ultimate, the thing that we're all striving for, and when they get there, they realize that thirst is not quenched. There is something more. It's never good enough. And C.S. Lewis, I'm going to read a little quote because C.S. Lewis kind of wraps it up for those of us who are, we're not the peaks in everything we're doing, but a lot of us are searching for true satisfaction in different places. And it's not just happiness. Pastor Dan talked about happiness in week one and how, you know, it's our lives aren't about happiness, but about holiness. And happiness is, if you've been living for maybe 20 or 30 years, you realize happiness is really kind of like that's such an insufficient, immature, lame thing to describe what it is we're looking for, right? And so most of us say, okay, well, it's not happiness, but there's something a little bit deeper than that. But here's what C.S. Lewis says about the things that we're pursuing. You know, it's possible for you to read in the back, so just trust me. But he says this, most people, if they really learned how to look into their own hearts, would know that they do want, and want acutely, something that cannot be had in this world. There are all sorts of things in this world that offer to give it to you, but they never keep their promise. The longings which arise in us when we first fall in love, or when we first think of some foreign country, or when we first take up some subject that excites us, these are longings which no marriage, no travel, and no learning can really satisfy. He says, I'm not speaking of what would ordinarily be called unsuccessful marriages or trips or so on. I'm speaking of even the best possible ones. There is something, though, that always we grasp at, and in the first moment of longing, it fades away in the reality. Oh, the spouse may be the great spouse. The scenery has been excellent, and it's turned out to be a wonderful job, but it has evaded us. It. What is it? Sprite knows that we are looking for it. And they're going to try to hustle us some cheap sugar water to help us find it. But at the same time, we are pursuing it. Everyone is pursuing it. And we are trying to find it, that true deep satisfaction, in something that's going to satisfy us the same way some sugar water is. We might find really good sense of meaning and purpose in being a great dad, husband, wife. We might have a great job where we find meaning and purpose. We might have some great experiences and go see some beautiful scenery. But at the end of the day, if we take it from the people who have actually achieved everything that they could possibly imagine, we can't find it. And what we realize is that the things that we think will quench our thirst leave us, in fact, more parched. There's a psychologist who wrote a book. He wrote a book, and he was actually trying to, it's called The Happiness Hypothesis. And he was trying to figure out, well, how do people throughout history pursue happiness? And he's actually one who kind of came up and said, happiness is a woefully insufficient way to describe what we're looking for. So he's talking about true satisfaction. Now, how do people throughout the history and generations of humanity, how do they cope with the idea that they're pursuing it? And how do they adjust to the idea that they, if we believe what C.S. Lewis says is true, that we are not going to actually find it in all of these other things? How do they adjust and how do they make sense of the world if they are trying to find it but they can't actually find it in all these other things? What do they do? What do people do? How do they respond? How do they deal with that? And he actually describes two ways through all of his research about ancient civilizations and modern civilizations. He describes kind of two approaches that people take. And he says there's an ancient way to approach this adjustment, this disappointment, this realization that I can't find it in anything on this world. There's an ancient way and there's a modern way. And I think we can learn something about maybe look in the mirror a little bit and say, how is this? Am I pursuing it? Am I adjusting to the pursuit of it? By looking at these two different ways. The first one is the ancient way. Now, this is the ancient way in that these are ancient Greeks and ancient Eastern philosophies, and they actually say, it is not out there, so stop trying to find it. They actually come to the conclusion, it's not out there. And there's kind of two reasons why, is that there's one group, kind of that kind of emerged out of Greek philosophy, is that it is not out there because there's really nothing beyond the material world, and so this is really it. It is just living. And so there is real, there is no it. There's no deep, true satisfaction. And this kind of just shows up in a way that one of the more popular, I think I mentioned a Stoic philosopher every time I'm up here, but they kind of emerge in all of my research. But is a guy, his name is Epictetus. And this is what he said. This is how it kind of shows up in their life. He says, while kissing our own child, whisper to yourself, in your mind, tomorrow you will die. What's he doing? What's he saying? He is essentially saying the response to the idea that I can't find it in anything on this world, he's saying emotionally guard yourself, detach yourself from the things that you love the most because you're not going to find purpose and meaning and you're going to do yourself a lot of harm, emotional harm, if you just don't detach. So every time you kiss your child, say, this is great, I can love my child, it'll be great, but I'm keeping my distance, I'm detaching my emotions. Something that emerged out of the Eastern ancient tradition is, you might have heard this if you have any idea about Buddhism. Buddhism, they have this famous phrase called, the world is due. The world is due. And unlike the Greeks, they don't think, well, there's only the physical, there's nothing beyond. What they are saying is that the physical is actually an illusion. This life is an illusion. So the world is due in that every time dew shows up, there's individual dew droplets, but your individuality is just an illusion. Ultimately, the dew will flow back into the ocean and we'll all be one. So if you know anything about Buddhist meditation, it's kind of the idea is that you rise above the physical. And again, the idea is detachment. I detach myself from this world because the pursuit of it doesn't exist, so I'm going to stop looking for it. But we're not ancients, right? We've all matured and evolved, right? We're smarter than those ancient people. So we got a whole new way of doing things in the modern way. And this is what the modern way says. The modern way says, it is in fact out there, so don't let anyone stand in your way of getting it. Of course, it's out there. everyone out of the way. I'm going to go find it. I'm going to identify and define what it is, and I'm going to go get it regardless of who's in my way. And because this is, you know, because the ancients, they weren't stupid, but, you know, we modern people think we're the smartest people who ever have lived, and we are pursuing this, but ultimately it ends up in failure. And so what happens? Well, the modern way creates us, it creates a couple different approaches, a couple different reactions as we pursue, yes, it's out there, get out of my way, I'm going to do everything I can to find it. And when we can't find it, something happens in us. And there's four different things that this writer identified who in the happiness hypothesis. He says, these aren't my words, like these are his conclusions. He says there's four things that show up in the modern people. And you might know some people like this. The first one is people become perpetually frantic. If I am pursuing it, get out of my way, don't stop me, I ultimately can't find it, so what happens? I become perpetually frantic. And what happens is I start to realize I don't have it, and I start looking for the better job, the better spouse, the better fill in the blank. It's got to be better. So what are they doing? They are blaming the things themselves, saying, if only my wife or spouse were better, then I would have it. So what do? I'm going to go find another spouse. If only my job were better, I'm going to upgrade my job. And so there is a franticness of always pursuing it, always upgrading to the better. And the result is that people become exhausted. What a life, right? What a life. So people can become perpetually frantic. The next one is they can become perpetually angry. Anyone know a perpetually angry person? No, don't raise your hand. Yeah, they might be mad at you. Perpetually angry people, they are pursuing the it, but because they can't find it, they can't actually achieve it, what do? They start realizing that, well, there's something in the way. There's something preventing me from achieving it. And it's not necessarily the thing, but they blame social forces. They blame a society that says, well, you can't do it. Someone is blocking your way. They blame somebody else and say, if this person would just get out of my way, I could get it. What they're doing is they're saying, society, something is broken and something's in my way. If only I had the freedom to pursue it free of all hindrances, then I would find it. And this is actually a little bit of truth, right? There's a little bit of truth in each of these, right? There's truth in being perpetually frantic because we all know that our marriages could be better, our jobs could be better, something could always be better, right? So there's a nugget of truth. There's a nugget of truth in this approach because, yes, there are forces, societal things that prevent me from pursuing what I want whenever I want. It's called living in society. Some of them are just, some of them are unjust, but that is a little bit of reality. But someone who's perpetually angry, they blame social forces and they become activists. The result is, well, I am going to pursue that freedom. I'm going to reduce these social forces, and I'm going to fix it so that I can have freedom. One of the little nuances is that once you achieve that freedom, you realize the people who are completely free don't have it either. So we become perpetually frantic, perpetually angry, and the third one he says is perpetually self-hating. Someone who's perpetually self-hating realizes, I can't achieve it, so who is to blame? I'm to blame. I'm obviously doing something wrong. Why can't I get my act together? Why am I screwing these things up all the time? I have all these lofty goals and dreams and ambitions, and I can't do it. I just can't do it, so I hate myself. And this, as you can tell, is a dangerous place to be. And it's dangerous because there is, as all of them, there's a little nugget of truth in each of them, right? How many of you think, yes, I could probably be better in some way? There's always something wrong with all of us all the time, right? Some of us more than others. We'll let you decide who falls into that category, but so what do? I blame myself. I can't achieve it because I'm doing something wrong. And the result is I become self-destructive. You can imagine a very dangerous place to be when I blame myself for not achieving it, my most truest, deepest desires. Then there's a fourth one, which is kind of the culmination of all of these three, and it is you can become deeply cynical. This might be for the older group in the room or joining us. Someone who becomes deeply cynical is someone who has spent their life trying to find it. They don't actually achieve it. They believe it's out there, but then they at the end they're just like, well, C.S. Lewis calls these people, he says, they become disillusioned, sensible people. So they realize they actually deeply believe it's out there, but they haven't found it, so they're disillusioned. So they become sensible. And it sounds like, well, when you get to my age, you'll stop chasing the rainbow. The sensible thing is to just stop trying to find it, because I haven't found it yet. And it sounds similar to the ancient way, because you would say, well, there's a detachment. It's actually more of a repression. You repress that desire. And so they blame the pursuit itself. That's the problem. And they become bitter. And this is a very dangerous place to be, because there's a difference between humanity and animals. And even if you're not a Christian, really the primary difference is that animals are just content to survive. Humans, even if you don't have any faith or don't believe in Christianity, everyone agrees that there is something deeper in the human nature. And if you take that away, you essentially gut the heart out of a human. So there's four different approaches in the modern way. So we have the ancient way. Again, we're responding. These aren't my words. This is a man who's looked at centuries and said, well, I'm pursuing it. I can't find it. And therefore, this is how we respond. It doesn't exist, so don't stop or stop looking. Or it is out there. Go find it at whatever cost. But as you are probably aware, this is an insufficient way to live your life. This doesn't sound very compelling to me. There is an alternative way, obviously, because we're in a church, we love Jesus, and we're myth-busting, right? So obviously we're going to look at what's the converse, what's the contrary approach, the unique Christian approach, and there is a Christian way. And the Christian way is this, is that it is out there, and it can be found, just not in this world. I derive a lot of joy from my family, from my wife, my kids. My daughter's a little over 2 years old, and so she's got a little sense of humor. I love putting her to sleep, even though sometimes it's crazy. I love watching her jump around. I love the fact that my wife is like, we should tell her to stop doing that. And I'm like, no, it'll be fine. Then she hurts herself, and I'm like, well, I probably should listen to my wife, right? But I mean, there is all sense of deep joy and meaning in my life, but ultimately, if I start searching for it in my wife, in my daughter, in my son, in my family, in my job, ultimately, I'm going to end up being, I can see myself in the future, a disillusioned, sensible person. But if we approach this rationally, even if you don't believe in Jesus, even if you don't really have a faith, right? I realize when I go to bed at night, I realize that my deep, truest satisfaction is not in my family, and it's not simply because I have a faith paradigm, which I view things, but there is something deeper. And there's this longing, and I engage lots of people who don't know Jesus, lots of people who are trying to make sense of this world, and there's depth of longing. And really, if we approach him, we say, well, I mean, really, is the Christian view really the one? Well, we can approach this rationally and say, well, yeah, it is. If we think about it, C.S. Lewis helps us figure it out. If we have these longings that can't be satisfied in this world, then there's something else. And here's what he says. He says, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. He says, a baby feels hunger. I got a 3-month-old, and he's 22 pounds, so he's hungry. But he feels hungry, and there is such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there is such a thing as water. When men feel sexual desire, well, there is such a thing as sex. If I find myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. So what does this look like? What is the solution? Where do we find our true, deep, quenching satisfaction? Jeremiah gives us the answer. Jeremiah, this is God speaking to the people of Israel and saying, well, you've broken all these promises. Here's what you've done. Here's the solution that I'm providing you. Here's what he says. He says, I will be their God, they will be my people, and they will not need to teach their neighbors, nor will they need to teach their relatives, saying, you should know the Lord. For everyone from the least to the greatest will know me already, says the Lord. And I will forgive their wickedness, and I will never again remember their sins. What's the solution that God has provided us that will quench our thirst? He says, you should know the Lord. C.S. Lewis posits the idea that we have a desire, and if that desire cannot be satisfied in this world, it is something beyond this world. And what is that deepest, truest desire? What is the satisfaction that we can find? And that is to know the very person who put that desire in us. Is that a creation to know the very creator that put in the sense of purpose in the first place, that put the thirst there. See, creation is not meant to satisfy you or me. It is meant to be joyful and pleasurable and peaceful, simply so that we would run after the ultimate source of joy and pleasure and peace, the one who will truly satisfy our hearts. This is why the psalmist says, my soul thirsts for the living God. Where can I go to meet him? This is why Augustine, one of the most brilliant men and brilliant theologians ever, he said, our hearts are restless, O Lord, until they find their rest in thee. To know our Creator is the ultimate quenching of the thirst. He is the person beyond this world, the person who gave us the thirst to begin with. But if you know anything about Christian theology, you will know that just simply saying you need to know God is only part of the answer. God goes one step further. The Creator goes one step further to make that happen. He actually says this, and I will forgive their wickedness, and I will never again remember their sin. Not only does he say, the source of your truest, deepest satisfaction is to know the Lord, but you can't actually know me because you've rejected me. There's a barrier. Our God goes deeper and further, and he says, I'm going to proactively remove that barrier so that you can, in fact, know me. He doesn't just sit up in heaven and say, hey, your truest, deepest satisfaction is to know the Lord, figure it out for yourselves. No, he's in heaven. He says, you need to know me. That is how you find true, deep, quenching satisfaction. And he proactively leaves heaven and comes to earth, becomes part of his creation, experiences the same physical thirsts that each and every one of us, even the same spiritual thirst that we have in his son, Jesus. Our Creator entered his creation in order to make a way for us to know him. And John captures this encounter between Jesus and the woman at the well, and he says this. As he's talking to this woman, he asks for some water. The Samaritan woman who's living in adultery and sin and someone that Jesus shouldn't even be talking to by cultural norms, he says, if you only knew the gift God is for you and who you were speaking to, you would ask me and I would give you living water. Who is she speaking with? She's speaking to what Colossians says, the person that through Jesus, everything was created. And for Jesus, everything was created. She's speaking to the creator of the universe. And she says, but sir, you don't have a rope for a bucket, she said. And this as well is very deep. Where would you get this living water? And besides, do you think you're greater than our ancestors, Jacob, who gave us this well? You think you're smarter than all those ancient people that we know? How can you offer better water than he and his sons and his animals enjoyed? Jesus replied, "Anyone who drinks this water will soon become thirsty again. But those who drink the water I give will never be thirsty again. It becomes a fresh, bubbling spring within them, giving them eternal life." Jesus is the it. Knowing God is the it, is the true, deep satisfaction that every single one of us is pursuing. And not only that, he made a way, he showed himself. We can know who God is because he showed up on earth as a human, had conversations with us, and says, "I will do the work to allow you to know me. And as a result, I will satisfy your deepest, truest thirst. You'll never be thirsty again." So the myth is contradicted with the truth, and that I can only find true satisfaction by knowing God. The beauty is that once I know God, everything changes. Once I have the it, everything changes. It actually allows me to overturn all of those other modern fallacies and how those things show up, right? I don't have to be perpetually frantic anymore. I can actually pursue the better without, while simultaneously resting in my identity in Jesus. I can rest in his completed work while also pursuing the better. It doesn't consume me. I don't have to be perpetually angry because I can pursue justice and help people find freedom and break down social constructs while all the while trusting in the goodness and greatness of God because I have the it. I don't have to be perpetually self-hating because I can work on self-improvement all the while knowing that I am accepted, loved, and approved based on nothing I did but on the work of Jesus. It doesn't matter what I do. He will always view me that way. And I don't have to be deeply cynical because I can help inspire and push and exhort people to go do incredible things, to go change the world, all while helping them realize that that's not the it. To keep the right perspective. When I find the it, it changes everything. And one day, when we realize, when Jesus comes again, and there's a new heaven and a new earth, we will live in eternity with God, knowing God, apart from sin, apart from the poison and brokenness of sin. And one of my favorite authors describes what this will look like, the true deep satisfaction. His name is Donald Miller, who ironically wrote a book called A Million Miles in a Thousand Years. It's about writing a better story with your life. And he actually has a marketing company called The Story Brand, which helps people tell their stories. But he writes this little snippet. He says, "I don't wonder anymore what I'll tell God when I go to heaven. When we sit in the chairs under the tree outside the city, I'll tell my story to God and he'll laugh, I think, and he'll remind me of the parts that I forgot, the parts that were his favorite. We'll sit and remember my story together, and then he'll stand, he'll put his arm around me and say, 'Well done,' and that he liked my story. And my soul won't be thirsty anymore. Finally, he'll turn and we'll walk toward the city, a city he will have spoken into existence, a city built in a place where once there'd be nothing. Where is the deepest, truest satisfaction, quenching of our thirst? It is in knowing God, and he has made a way to know him through the work of his son, Jesus." Let's sing and remember this together.